particular hearing. If I may say a few words at the outset about the process itself, I mentioned that the most recent genesis of the WIPO part of the process was the white paper published in June of this year. We are, however, well aware that discussions have been carried on intensely internationally in the course of the last 2 years. And I should say at the very outset that it is not our intention at WIPO to lose sight of those discussions or of all of the learning that emerged in the course of those discussions. It is a somewhat new process for WIPO as an intergovernmental organization because it is a process which in the first place is carried out largely directly with the interested parties, with the interested circles. We understand that this is the case, first of all, because of the nature of the subject matter of the process, that is, that it is largely concerned, the WIPO process is largely concerned with the possible establishment of mechanisms, as opposed to norms, mechanisms for the resolution of very practical problems that arise as a result of the intersection of the traditional intellectual property rights as they have been organized in the physical world based on separate territories with the attributes of sovereignty, and on the other hand, a global medium in which domain names operate to give global access to the holder of the domain name. We understand that another reason for carrying out the process direct with interested parties is that the domain name system has largely arisen as an ad hoc system which has up until now been almost entirely privately administered, so that there is an intersection also between public authorities on the one hand, those that dispense intellectual property rights as we have been used to them up until now, and on the other hand, these new species of spontaneously mutated intellectual property rights, which are domain names. It's also a new process for WIPO insofar as the modalities that are being used or that we are using are concerned. The chief modality is, of course, the use of the website that we have established for the purpose of this process. It has been an active website. We hope that it will become even more active as the process progresses. We now have some 507 persons or entities from over 50 countries that have registered on the website to receive direct mailings concerning the process. And at the moment, we are experiencing somewhere around about 20 to 25,000 hits per month on the website. And we hope that that is something that will increase as the process gathers momentum and becomes more known. Despite the fact that it is a process that we are carrying out direct with the interested parties, we do have, and we have just received, in fact, the approval of our member states to undertake this process. And it would not have been possible for us to have continued the process without that approval, or without the close cooperation throughout the rest of the process with our member states. We are particularly grateful for this reason also to the European Commission for the work that it has done with respect to its own member states in supporting WIPO's role. And we think that this cooperation, particularly in the organization of the hearings that are being conducted throughout the world with our member states, even though the process is concerned direct with private parties, as it were, is an indispensable element in the process. If I may say a few words just about some of the basic principles that we think underlie the process. First of all, it goes without saying that WIPO being an international organization, we wish to seek to attract the widest possible geographical representation or participation in the process. We are, for this reason, holding 11 regional hearings in this first round, and we will hold an additional 6 or so hearings, regional hearings, in January next year. In addition to the widest possible geographical participation, As a second principle, we also wish to attract the widest possible sectoral participation in the process. While it is concerned with intellectual property rights, we do feel that any recommendations that may be made as a result of the process must have technical viability. It is therefore very important that any such recommendations not only be legally practical, but also technically practical. And for this reason, we wish to hear the views and obtain the participation of not only the trademark community, but also the internet engineering community, and the very important, or at least vocal, free speech or public interest lobby. A third principle that we are applying in the process is that we do regard it as an open process. That is, despite the fact that there have been fairly intensive discussions for a period of over 2 years now, we do feel that it is important that WIPO, as the institution managing the process, not have any a priori solutions and not have any a priori recommendations concerning any of the issues which are under examination in the process. That is not to say, as I mentioned earlier, that we intend to ignore all of the submissions and all of the learning that came out of the discussions prior to the initiation of this particular process. Finally, as a principle of the process, as an organizational principle, we have appointed a panel of experts to assist us in the prosecution of the process. We regard the role of experts as one in which their primary function will be to advise us in respect of the issues from the point of view of the particular sector with which they are most familiar. We do not expect experts to be advocates of any particular view. We do, however, expect the experts to be somewhat akin to party-appointed arbitrators. That is to say that while they will be neutral and will play a neutral role, one of their functions will be to ensure that the interests and needs and concerns of the sector with which they're most familiar are not overlooked in the course of the process and are given appropriate articulation and expression. We have distributed, or we have made available, a list of the experts that we have appointed to assist us in the process. And may I take this opportunity to introduce immediately on my right, Mr. Harold Alvestrand, who is the Area Director for Operations and Management of the Internet Engineering Task Force, and who's a national of Norway. And on the far right of the table, Mr. Bardevine Niederkorn, who is the chairman of the Right Centre. And I believe that we are just being joined by Madame Marie-Lise Filbert, who is the director of the Trademarks Department of Santé Labo in France. A little later in the morning, we will also be joined by Mr. Geert Glass, who is from Belgium, and he's the chair of the INTA, the International Trademark Association's Internet Subcommittee, and will be standing in today for Mr. Frederik Mostert, the president of INTA. May I also introduce one of my colleagues, Mr. David Mules, who is a senior legal officer in the electronic commerce section at WIPO, and who is at home here in Belgium, being a national of Belgium. Let me say then one or two words about the various stages in the process. The stages are really conceived around three requests for comments. The first of those was issued, as you know, earlier in the year, and concerned the terms of reference, if you like, of the process and the procedures that we intended to use in the course of the process, as well as the timetable, which is a somewhat intense one. That first request for comments closed, and we have consequently issued a second request for comments, which is available or has been made available outside, on the issues of the process concerned or that the process will examine. And it is on this second RFC and on the issues that it covers that today's hearing will be held. Following the round of regional consultations that is at present being held, it is intended that we should draft, with the assistance of our experts, a preliminary or interim set of recommendations or report, and make that available at the commencement of next year. Or in mid-December this year, David?
Yes.
Mid-December this year. That interim set of recommendations will in turn be the subject of a further round of regional hearings, as well as a request for comments on our internet site. I will say a few words in one moment, and my colleague David Mühls will say a few words in one moment about the practical arrangements for today's hearing. But if at this stage I may interrupt that simply to thank you all for attending this morning. We are extremely grateful that you are so numerous this morning, and we are extremely grateful to the Commission for all of the assistance and support that it has given in order to publicise this particular hearing. And with that, may I ask Mr. Wottershort to say a few words.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I don't think it's working.
Yes.
Yes. So, good morning, everybody. Also, welcome from the side of the Commission. We are very happy to participate in this consultative process, which has been organized by WIPO. I'm Paul Wottershort. I'm a director in the Internal Market Directorate of the Commission. And in my area, we deal with industrial property, copyright, and some regulatory issues regarding to media and electronic commerce. I'm also very pleased that this hearing is held here in Brussels, in the sense that from the Commission's point of view, it is extremely important that European views are heard in this debate. The WIPO exercise is part of a larger reflection which we have started in the Commission for some time regarding the functioning of the internet and electronic commerce. We've already produced a number of documents regarding the internet and electronic commerce. We have produced a directive on digital signature. There has been a communication regarding the illegal and harmful content on the internet. We have a major directive on copyright, which is presently discussed in Council and in Parliament. And we are now working on a directive regarding electronic commerce and the contractual arrangements regarding electronic commerce, including the very sensitive issue of liability. The discussions on trademarks and the internet, I think, should be governed by a number of principles. And you've already mentioned a certain number of them. I think it is important that there is a balanced representation of international organizations, private sector interests in this process. I also think that some degree of competition in the allocation of the domain names is a useful principle, and the need for transparency is essential. Originally, the function of domain names was to facilitate connectivity between computers in the internet, and using business identifiers has, of course, led to a conflict with the use of trademarks. And we all know the value of these trademarks in the commercial environment and the underlying tensions which flows from this. The Commission attaches great importance to the recognition and the protection of intellectual property, both in the traditional sense, in the analog world, and in the new digital environment. And we, as I've already mentioned, we have proposed a global directive as regards to the protection of copyright, and we think that the debate presently regarding domain names and trademarks is part of this whole debate. Coming back to trademarks and the process of the Green Paper and the White Paper started in the US, I think that we're concerned that there are a number of requirements which should be complied with. And I think that one of them is that the role of WIPO should be recognized for all the areas which concern the conflicts between domain names and intellectual property rights. It's the most evident organization and which is best qualified for this type of task, so we very much support the process that has been started by WIPO. During the course of 97, a intensive international effort were undertaken in the preparation of a dispute settlement system. And I think it is important that this work, and which was undertaken then, and the present consultative process, that the result of this work should not be lost. And we have to ensure that the new organizations which are put into place take account of this work. I think there are three elements in the work which has been undertaken by WIPO which is of relevance. One is the prevention and resolution of disputes. The other is the protection of famous trademarks on the internet. And the third area is the consequences of the introduction of new generic top-level domain names on trademarks. These are different areas, and the importance of these different areas are different. I think for us, from the Commission's point of view, the area of prevention is of the utmost importance. And I think that the discussions which will take place today will very much be of relevance to this particular issue. The other area, which is the process of resolving disputes, I think it is of importance to stress that this process should be uniform. And I think that if one would have different types of dispute settlements for different areas, it would create confusion and it should be avoided. That means that in the long term we should also accept that or encourage national organizations to apply or enter to the same system of dispute settlement. Turning now to the area of famous trademark, which was the second subject I mentioned in my list. I think that this creates a particular problem in the sense that we have to agree to some kind of criteria which is relevant for these famous trademark in the context of the internet. And here again, I think that the discussions today will very much be of relevance. And finally, I think that there is some work that has to be done in studying the repercussions of the introduction of new generic top-level domains on trademarks. So these are the different issues which, from the Commission's point of view, are very much of relevance in this consultative process. And I would encourage you very much to participate as much as possible in this debate and submit your different comments, because it is important to get this system right and to avoid that in the future too many conflicts, I mean some conflicts will occur, but too many conflicts will occur, and that the valuable trademarks could be put into danger, which I think is something we should all avoid. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walterschott. May I just go through very briefly some of the practical arrangements that we foresee for today's hearing? The first is that it is in the nature of a hearing, so that what we would like to do is to listen as much as possible. My colleague David Nudes will outline in one moment how it is we intend to deal with the formal presentations, as it were, that will be made or that certain persons have registered to make, and then how we will deal with the open discussion following those formal presentations. Insofar as possible, I'm most grateful to Mr. Walterschott for having outlined the issues that we will be dealing with this morning. In particular, insofar as possible, we would ask you to confine your interventions to those issues and not to stray too much into the broader issues of the process that is taking place independently of WIPO. You should feel absolutely free to speak in either English or in French. We have simultaneous interpretation available. We would ask those who will be making, as it were, formal presentations of views, if they wouldn't mind speaking from the podium that we have over there. As far as anyone else is concerned, in the course of the open discussion, you may feel free either to use that microphone, or there is a gentleman who will be circulating around the room with a microphone. Today's proceedings will be recorded, and we do intend to make available the transcript of the proceedings on our website. We have done this with the first hearing held at San Francisco. The transcript is not yet available on our website, but we intend today's transcript to be made available on the website. Now, if I may ask David Mules to let us know how we're going to proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As explained by Mr. Gurry, this is very much an information gathering exercise, as opposed to the normal conferences where people on the bench would speak. It is the intention that most of the input comes from the participants in the room. As you may know, there are basically three formats in which a person can participate in this hearing. The first format is just to simply attend and listen to what's going on. The second format is to actually make a formal presentation to the panel of experts and WIPO. And the third format is to listen to a formal presentation and then make observations on the formal presentation made in the form of comments. A number of people have indicated that they wanted to make a formal presentation, and I will go through the list of those people in a second. I think it is to be expected that some of these people may arrive in the course of the day. It's not absolutely sure that they are here now, so there will be a need for a certain degree of flexibility of when people will speak. On the basis of the number of people that have indicated that they wish to make a formal presentation, we have approximately 25 to 30 minutes per person that wishes to make a presentation, and we would suggest that the person in question speaks for approximately 15 minutes and that the remaining 15 minutes is reserved for comments and questions by the audience and comments or questions by the panel. As Francis explained, you can make your presentations in French and English. You should, however, each time you make a presentation, go to a microphone that will be either available in the room or to the one on the podium. And please, for the purposes of this transcript, it would be useful each time you make an intervention to clearly state your name and your affiliation so that this can be properly reflected in the documents. With your permission, I will now go through the list of persons that have indicated that they wish to make a formal presentation, and I will each time mention their name and affiliation. If anybody who wishes to make a formal presentation is not mentioned here, I would ask them to raise their hand and then we will add them to the list. First, Mr. Abril I. Abril, legal and policy advisor of Nominalia and Core. Dr. Willie Black, managing director of Nominet and member of the GTLD MOU Policy Oversight Committee. Mr. Keith Geimer, IP advisor for British Telecom. Mr. Howard Hill, know-how and information services manager for Rouse & Co. International. Mr. Paul Kane, chairman of Internet Computer Bureau PLC. Mrs. Isabelle Leroux, avocat associé Dubarry, Le Douarin, Vail. Mr. Philip Shepherd, managing branding affairs, AIM European Brands Association. Mrs. Daphne Young-Dervé, policy manager, International Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Walter Betting, attorney, Houthoff. And Mr. John Wood, consultant, Microsoft. May I suggest Mr. John Wood? Is there any other person who wishes to make a presentation in addition to the names? Of course, you will always be able to give feedback on a presentation that's given, so. Okay. If we could start with Mr. John Wood, please.
Good morning, everybody. My name is John Wood. I'm a consultant for Microsoft Inc., America Online Inc. I also do consultancy for British Telecom and a number of other key companies involved in this debate. I'm a member of the International Chamber of Commerce Task Force on Domain Names, also a member of the European Panel of Participants, and a member of the Private Sector Working Group, which is a group of between 30 and 40 companies in the United States that are key trademark brand holders, including such companies as Bell Atlantic, Walt Disney, Microsoft, Procter & Gamble, American Express, Warner Lambert, etc., etc., etc. We have been involved in this process for approximately 2 years, the Private Sector Working Group, in the former process that WIPO was involved in, provided comments to the substantive guidelines number one and number two. We also have thoroughly supported this process and welcome this development and have participated in San Francisco. We also participate in Washington, D.C., and feel that this is a very worthwhile exercise. Obviously, our perspective is one of emphasizing the need to protect trademarks and domain name holders' rights in a fashion that enables that both those rights are recognized and protected. The first area that I would like to consider in response to the RFC 2, and I will have to put on my computer in a second, so there will be a slight pregnant pause whilst I fire up and do things, but I would like to pick up on several things that were mentioned by the Honorable Walter Schutt, which was the idea of balanced representation within the panel of experts and the need for competition and the need for full transparency. We welcome completely the idea that there should be transparency and would ask that as much business participation occurred as possible. In terms of the panel, we welcome the fact that there are some experts that are from the trademarks, but we will also be submitting studies because we feel that this is an area which clearly needs information that would enable that to occur. In terms of representing their own constituency, we still feel that there is a need for greater participation by business and are trying to mobilize people both in the United States and here in terms of that goal. I'm sorry about this, but I have to actually fire this up. No, it's got a battery. It's not a presentation, it's just my notes. I'd like to basically go through the different areas of the RFC 2 and first of all begin with some observations and to essentially ask questions as well as also posit points. The first one was that we obviously welcomed the idea that the prior work that had been done by the GTLD MOU process would be inputted into this. We would obviously ask that although that may be the case, that this should be an open process, for there is still those that may believe that by linking it to the former process that was not completely a comprehensive and open dialogue, that there may still be issues. We'd also like clarification with regard to that, because that process was aborted towards the end, as to which parts would be inputted into this process and which parts wouldn't be. There have been some of those that have been involved in this process that have indicated that they felt that it would be the second iteration, the second substantive guidelines proposal, not the third substantive guidelines proposal, which would be the area of greatest consideration. Obviously, those were dramatically different. The other issue is that clearly in the first substantive guidelines that were actually put out by the World Intellectual Property Organization, the focus had been famous trademarks, but that in the process with which WIPO was involved, that was withdrawn within the second substantive guidelines. So if there is to be input from the prior process, it would be a good area of clarification to say which parts will be included and which parts would not. The second issue which concerns us is, I'm sure, one that also concerns the World Intellectual Property Organization, is whether these actual proceedings will be actually mandated or in some way ensured that in part or in whole that they will be implemented by the interim board and the subsequent permanent board. Because it seems to us that this is a wonderful process, but if it is not in any way going to actually occur, that would actually be in that process, then I wonder what is really going on. The third actual consideration is the scope of the work, in the sense that I know that members of the Commission have indicated, and also if we look at this in comparison with the white paper itself, it has increased the scope of work beyond what the white paper said was what they anticipated WIPO would concentrate on, namely dispute resolution policy and the issue of the general issue of collision between trademarks and domain names. Although we welcome, and in our comments and the comments in the organizations that I've been involved in, the wider look at the impact, we would also ask that the World Intellectual Property Organization does also look at issues such as the harmonization of trademarks in the long run and the issue of directories, which are also very important to the long-term resolution and not merely the short-term issues that we currently have. With specific consideration of the issue of prevention, we would recommend to WIPO the former work done by the International Trademark Association and also the comments of the PSWG with regard to the type of information that should be in the application and also in other documentation and in the good practices of the individual registrars in terms of ensuring, for example, that the person that actually applies for a domain name gives a place where service may be processed, that the person that applies for it gives some kind of declaration that the work, that the application is a bona fide one, that they do not in any way know of a famous mark or any other form of mark that their application would in some way infringe. So those are some of the things that we feel from a prevention point of view would be significant, but I do not want to, for a matter of brevity and time, go through the complete list. The submissions of both Inter and the submissions of the Private Sector Working Group enumerate all of those different areas that we feel are of great concern. We move on to the area of famous trademarks, the thorny issue. My main question is, would this be a parallel work to the work already initiated by the World Intellectual Property Organization on the issue of famous trademarks, or would this be a complementary work or a subset of that work? So it would be very useful to have some form of clarification, because we do not need duplication here. One of the other suggestions that has been made is the fact that with regard to famous trademarks, that perhaps a special classification purely for the internet should be developed. With this, I go back to the first substantive guidelines. Within that first substantive guidelines, there was a reference to this area of a regional basis and criterion. As you probably know, those in this audience and obviously those that would have seen the comments, we were very concerned about the regionality and the criterion that was set. But quite clearly, there may be a great deal of use in this process, clearly defining a specific subset right for famous trademarks. The third area which was enumerated this morning was the area of the impact study. And what I would like to say about that is that the companies that I'm involved with are most concerned that there are certain people that have put forward and posited certain studies which clearly seem to indicate the idea that there isn't a problem. I can tell you, standing here on behalf of 20 to 30 of the largest brand holders and trademark holder companies in America, the idea that there isn't a problem came to them as a great surprise.
as increasingly amounts of their resources, time and energy is spent on these, and the number of cases that aren't reported and the number of situations grows by leaps and bounds. Our basic principle on this is twofold. First and foremost, we are not against the idea of having new GTLDs. We are against the idea of there not being an effective legal and commercial framework that does not in some way ensure that the situation is alleviated and ameliorated as opposed to exacerbated. And therefore, any dispute resolution policy, any forms and applications, and any form of best practices and procedures must ensure that legal rights are protected, that consumers are not confused, but that consumers have confidence that when they click on the domain name, it does relate to the source of origin to which they would believe, in a reasonable sense of that, that it relates to. Therefore, we will be submitting to WIPO a group of cases, but obviously because of confidentialities and other things that some of them may be in related to ongoing litigation, would want the liberty of obviously being somewhat discreet, but at least indicating quite clearly to this body that there is absolutely a problem. The problem is not going away, it is getting worse, and without an effective legal and commercial framework, the situation would not be improved by merely putting a dispute resolution policy. That is an after-the-fact solution as opposed to dealing with it as it should be done. We also welcome the Leahy bill and its passage through both the Senate and the House in the United States, and believe that it would be useful for other regions, for example in Europe, to conduct a specific study so that whilst the WIPO process gives us a macro global view, that regional studies may be able to deal with specific legal and commercial issues that pertain to specific regions. With regard to the dispute resolution policy, it was suggested this morning that it should be uniform. We would suggest that uniform does not mean that there is merely one dispute resolution policy, but that there should be a uniform set of best standards and basic rules and requirements that would be practiced by all of those, and would say that WIPO is in a perfect position in order to come to what may be the basic terms which could be included, because we would obviously be against anything that may lead to some form of forum shopping. And really at that point, a combination of my wacky software, that finishes my sort of presentation. I'm sorry if I spoke too fast.
Sure, Mr. John Wood. I know that I am always the subject of complaints from the interpreters for speaking far too quickly. So I wonder if I may ask everyone who intervenes to have some indulgence for the interpreters, and we ought to endeavour to speak a little more slowly. Thank you, John, for those extremely comprehensive remarks. May I ask you to stay there? I know that you did address a number of questions to WIPO specifically, yep. So perhaps if I may make some observations on those before asking whether anyone else would like to make any observations on the presentation of Mr. John Wood or ask any questions of Mr. John Wood. You asked for some clarification as to which parts would and would not be taken into account, which parts of the former process, if I may call it, so call it. And I think that our attitude at this stage, subject to the control of our experts, is that we would take into account all parts of the former process, in the sense that the first set of substantive guidelines proposed one series of solutions and gave rise to one set of reactions. The second set of guidelines proposed another series of solutions and gave rise to another set of reactions. And I think that what we would like to do is to take account of all reactions that were expressed to the various different formulations of substantive guidelines that were articulated in the course of last year. And obviously the more recent we view as being those that have built on the experience of the previous reactions. Secondly, you asked whether the results of the WIPO process are guaranteed of implementation by the new corporation. We think that that is an open question in the sense that it really, the answer we feel will depend on the success of our process. If we do succeed in reaching some form of consensus, and that is our objective, and what we understand by consensus is that is not a set of recommendations that are going to satisfy the interests and concerns of every sector 100%, but that are such that every sector can live with them, that no particular sector will veto, will say this is impossible, that the technical community will say this is not, will say it's impossible to implement, to live with such a mechanism. That is what we understand by consensus. If we do succeed in that process, then we don't see that there is any obstacle to the acceptance of the recommendations. But obviously we're not in a position to guarantee the actions of another party. Concerning famous trademarks, it is perhaps the area in which, frankly speaking, there is the greatest tension between the traditional public law process of an intergovernmental organization and this new process where we are dealing with direct with interested parties in the private sector. It is not our intention to replicate here the work that is going on within the WIPO Standing Committee on Trademarks. And as you are well aware, within the WIPO Standing Committee on Trademarks, there has been work now for a number of years on the definition of a well-known mark since the now 150 contracting states of the Paris Convention are all obliged to protect famous marks or well-known marks without any such definition having been elaborated on the international level. We see the question as it is put to us in this process as being, first of all, a procedure or mechanism for protecting famous marks within this environment of domain names. Now, assuming that we are able to develop a consensual recommendation as to an appropriate mechanism or procedure, then it, the question becomes what guidelines will be applied within by that mechanism or within that mechanism or within that procedure. And there we would look, first of all, to the results of the work that has been carried out by our member states, and secondly, to the substantive guidelines. Finally, from my part, one other comment only, and that is that we are most grateful for your offer to submit some empirical evidence of the difficulties that is out there, and we will of course respect the confidentiality of the details of the disputes that you do submit to us, and we feel observations to Mr. John Wood.
Thank you for the opportunity.
No observations or questions? Okay, well thank you very much for the presentation. I suggest that we have time for one further presentation before we break for morning coffee, and I would ask Mr. Walter Bettink, please, from Huthoff Law Firm. You're most welcome, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for this opportunity to present some views on the questions that have been raised in RFC 2. First, a little bit on my background. My name is Walter Bettink. I'm a Dutch lawyer from the firm of Houthoff. that in itself is not a qualification to stand here. I am an intellectual property lawyer involved in trademark matters. That is some qualification, perhaps. I'm interested in the all legal aspects of internet. We're getting towards the goal. And I have been the advisor of the Dutch Domain Name Authority since May 1996 and have been involved in devising the registration rules for that domain name authority. So that basically is the reason, well, the reason that I'm standing here is that I have been invited by the Dutch Domain Name Authority to present my views, which are not necessarily those of the Dutch Domain Name Authority. I think that as a general statement, I would like to say that WIPO has taken a very important and also a very huge task in trying to devise rules in an area where already so many national and international rules exist. And if one goes out to do that, I think it is important to always ask the question, is it necessary, the effort? And I know that in this forum where already so much work has been done before, maybe it is like, as we say in Holland, cursing in the church. But nevertheless, as you know, Dutchmen are very liberal as far as freedom of speech is concerned. I would like to make an effort in that direction, but don't take me too literally in that respect. I think one of the things that has that struck me when I followed this process is that it seems there is a conviction that it's possible to devise rules for a dispute resolution procedure which can exist in isolation of the rules that already exist. And that, of course, is not the case. When you devise a dispute resolution procedure like the one that we are discussing today, one of the most important things is to decide on the criteria to resolve the disputes. In other words, very simply put, which rights will be taken into account in case of a domain name challenge? Who can challenge the domain name? I think that's a very principal question. If you ask five trademark mark lawyers, you will get five different answers. To give you an idea, in the United States, you can get a trademark right merely through the use of a trademark. In the Benelux, that is impossible. You have to register the trademark. The question, therefore, is do you recognize, for instance, American trademark rights that were obtained by use, or do you restrict yourself to trademarks that have been registered? That's one question. Then the registration procedure, registration requirements are very different in different countries. And for instance, in the Benelux, we have a system, as in many other countries, where descriptive trademarks are refused. That is not the case in every country. In some jurisdictions, you have the possibility to oppose a trademark when there is a conflict, but that is not a possibility in all jurisdictions. Then, in addition to trademarks, you may have other rights, in particular corporate names, which do not necessarily have to be registered as a trademark. Are these to be taken into account, and how do they value on the scale of rights that may be invoked to challenge a domain name? Now, these are just some of the questions with respect to the substantive rules which should be involved in such a dispute resolution procedure. In addition, there will, of course, have to be devised many procedural rules. And these relate to evidence that can be presented, relates to the duration of the procedure, relates to the selection of the people who will decide. Of course, one important thing is that we have just heard Mr. John Wood, and I'm very much, as a trademark lawyer, in favor of trademark rights. But on the other hand, one should acknowledge that trademark rights may also be owned by very small companies, and that those small companies should also be protected. And procedural rules are also, in principle, there to protect the rights of small companies. I think that is important to keep in mind, especially when you are thinking of a procedure here which should be very speedy, which should perhaps have no appeal, no recourse to summary proceedings, injunction proceedings. That may all be very well if you are a big trademark owner and you have very clear trademark rights, but it may be put to the rights of small companies in jeopardy. To give you a very simple example, there may be a trade name owner in Italy who has a right to a trade name which is identical to a trademark which is owned by a company in the UK or in the Benelux. Now, who has the stronger right in a situation like that? That's a question, of course, you cannot answer without the facts, but it's a situation you have to take into account and keep in mind when devising, in particular, also procedural rules. They have to be very careful. So I said it's an important task that WIPO has undertaken. It's a huge task, and it's also a task which raises the preliminary question, is it necessary to be fulfilled? Do we need a new alternative dispute resolution procedure, or should we just take recourse to the courts? I've heard Mr. John Wood say that there are great difficulties out there and examples. I don't know whether I will have the privilege to look at his examples, but to my admittedly not all-encompassing knowledge of the cases, only cases that have been reported, the outcome of 99 of 100 cases is very satisfactory, although the legal reasoning may not always be what it needs to be. I personally would favor just tempering on with the current situation, and because I think the results right now are not all that bad, and because I think drafting new rules will involve many difficulties which will appear to be insurmountable. Well, that was my opening statement, but of course I've also looked at the questions that have been posed, because I would like to offer some thoughts for, I think, the many people in the audience who just want to get on with the job and would like to have answers to the questions. What I've done is put down a number of notes. What I plan to do is also put it down in writing, so I could just pick out a few points now and then send you the document afterwards so that you can look at it more precisely and look at all the details. I think one of the important things which I already mentioned is the question, should appeal be excluded? Because that's important to safeguard the rights of all concerned. And personally, I think that in order to preserve those rights, an appeal should not be excluded. At the same time, if you go for an alternative dispute resolution procedure, the question is whether you should exclude summary proceedings, injunction proceedings, you know, a very quick form of procedure which gives you a preliminary right. In view of the fact that it here concerns the question yes or no, will you get the domain name or not, will you keep the domain name or not, I don't think that you should use such summary proceedings. It takes, again, to warrant and protect the rights of all concerned, everything should be looked at very carefully. Everybody should have the opportunity to provide evidence, and extensive as possible evidence, to have its claims looked at. And so I don't think there should be a form of summary proceedings. I don't see anything in a waiting period, and I'm now turning to the preventive site. I don't see anything in a waiting period for the domain name applicant, for the simple reason that I don't know what he should wait for. I mean, if you register, formalities have to be checked. And by the way, I do think it is a good idea to wait until the money has been paid, because that's always, you know, the only incentive for people to pay money is if they still have something to get. So I should say, you know, answer to that question is fairly easy. But in addition to that, I don't think there should be a waiting period for the activation of a new domain name registration. Get on with it, and if there is a problem, if there is somebody else who's claiming rights, that's a question to be solved later on, as it is in many countries now with trademarks and corporate names. At the same time, if you are looking for a dispute resolution procedure, what you would need indeed is a database of all domain name registration to enable trademark owners to search for, first of all, domain names that are available, but also for conflicting domain names. So I think that's a very good idea as well, and that will assist trademark owners in protecting their rights, and I think that's absolutely an essential requirement for that. One of the things that I would like to put forward as far as prevention is concerned is something which is not perhaps in this document, but it's drawn from the experience that we had in the Netherlands. One of the first things we did, and I'm sure that we were not the first to do it, was to demand from each applicant a statement, which could be included in this contract that is proposed here, a statement in which the applicant says that it will hold harmless the registration authority for any infringement of third-party rights that appear afterwards. In addition to that, the statement includes a declaration, a statement by the applicant saying that it, to the best of its knowledge, the domain name does not infringe any third-party rights. This has been, at least in the Netherlands, been a very effective means also for the registration authority to compel domain name applicants in certain situations to cooperate with a challenger. Because, of course, we have been faced in the Netherlands also with situations of cyber squatting. In those situations, the registration authority sometimes was drawn into the procedure. If it was, it would invoke this statement and would say to the applicant, well, look, you, I've promised to hold this harmless, so you have to pay all our damages and fees. And at the same time, the domain name authority pressed upon the applicant the need to seek a solution for the problem. The problems we had were always problems where the applicant clearly was at fault, so it was quite easy to take a position there. And it has helped. We have been able to solve all these problems outside of court. Domain names have been transferred, and proceedings have not been necessary. The only exception in the Netherlands, there's only one case that has come to court. That was a .com domain name. But the .nl disputes have always been solved. I just have a few remarks. I don't know how much time I have left. 5 more minutes. Thank you. About the dispute resolution itself. I think if you opt for a dispute resolution procedure, it should be restricted to cyber piracy. The problem that we have with first-come, first-served policy leading to two or more rightful owners of the domain name because they have trademark rights which conflict or corporate name rights which conflict should not be a matter for dispute resolution. It should be a matter for the companies involved to solve because it is a matter which cannot be resolved by any court, arbitrator or whatever. It is just a matter of conflicting legal rights. There may be solutions, of course, offered. One solution which you see now on the web is the so-called portal site. Delta.com is an example where you have a web page, a home page, which is under the domain name Delta.com and which indicates that it is home to various deltas. And then you just click on the delta you are looking for. So if it's Delta Airlines, you click on the banner for Delta Airlines. If it is Delta Electricity Company, you click on that. That is a solution which you can see now in practice, and it could be considered, for instance, to ask the to include in the contract for the registration of the new GTLDs to ask of each applicant to agree to such a portal site, to operate such a portal site, if it turns out that there are other rightful owners to the same domain name. However, I say it could be included, and it seems at first hand perhaps like a very good solution. On the other hand, again, it takes somebody who decides what are equal rights, and I've already indicated to you the great difficulties and the great differences between countries in this respect. So the solution may not be as easy to implement as it seems at first hand. Anyway, I think this whole issue should be outside the dispute resolution. Dispute resolution, if it is adopted, should be restricted to cyber piracy. One of the important things which I would also like to point out is that I have already mentioned in my initial comments that substantive rules will have to be drafted, the criteria on which to judge a dispute, and procedural rules. An alternative could be, of course, to choose one particular law which everybody likes. It will not be easy to choose, but it may be something that could be left to the registrars involved. For instance, it would be, suppose that we have a registrar in Spain, and I don't know whether many of you liked it, the Spanish trademark law, but that it is at least very new. The registrar in Spain could decide to adopt Spanish law and say, well, you know, all the disputes that are with respect to domain names that I register are to be judged by Spanish law, and you agree to that through this contract, this registration contract that has been proposed. So that would mean that you would have for each new generic top-level domain a different applicable law. Of course, it is better to have one law, but if the difficulty in drafting that law is impossible to solve, this might be an alternative solution. Likewise, with respect to procedural rules, you could look for the rules of arbitration institutes in various countries. As you know, you have an arbitration institute in France, you have the International Chamber of Commerce in France, you have one in Stockholm, in London, in the Netherlands. Those are rules of procedure that have proved themselves in practice, and they could be adopted. And perhaps you could ask each registrar to decide on which rules to adopt. A final comment I have on the protection of famous and well-known trademarks. I have difficulty in imagining the need for such a protection on the one end, as I have already indicated, and on the other hand, suitable criteria for a famous and well-known trademark. I know that we have had the concept of a famous trademark since 1883, when the Paris Convention was enacted. But I don't think that there is agreement among all those countries, I think there are over 120 now, that have signed the Paris Convention on what a famous trademark is. In addition, for instance, in the Benelux, we have introduced the notion of a well-known trademark 2.5 years ago, and nobody knows what it is. It hasn't been tested by court, but it's something lesser than famous, but probably more than unknown. Anyway, you know, there's a great problem of definition there, and I think that many of the companies that Mr. Wood represents would probably qualify for a famous trademark, but I wonder what additional protection such trademarks would need in addition to the protection that they have under the Paris Convention and under the various national trademark laws. Thank you very much.
Mr. Betting, thank you very much for those observations. There are 150 states party to the Paris Convention. I certainly have one or two questions that I would like to ask you, if I may, but I'm sure there are other people who would like to ask Mr. Betting some questions or make some observations on his comments. Please, sir. Yes. I wonder if I may ask you to state your name for the record.
This is John Wood. What I would say is that I would like you to respond to the observation that cyber squatting and that form of entrepreneurship focuses considerably on famous and well-known marks. That is the currency within which they operate to a large extent. They aren't that interested in the small companies, they are interested in large companies and deep pockets. And therefore, there is clearly a correlation and a linkage between the two. And whether you introduce one new GTLD or the existing ones, cyber squatters are quite clearly in the marketplace of finding out famous trademarks, so I can't see how you can divide one from the other. It is a function of one that leads to the experience with the other.
Yes, I think you're correct in that. My only answer to that is that that is already the case right now, and as far as I can see, the decisions that I have seen have always given the rights to the owner of the famous or well-known national trademark. And that comes back to my earlier observation, you know, whether that is really necessary to provide for an alternative dispute resolution procedure and extra protection for famous and well-known trademark.
Thank you. Mr. Watterschart.
Yes. Mr. Betting. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Mr. Betting's intervention raised a very fundamental problem, and it has to do with the degree of harmonization of the substantive law which is necessary for having an effective prevention or dispute settlement mechanism. In some instances, I got the impression that we were very much on the in the area which the community deals with when it has to do with this type of legislation, which is harmonization of the national laws which are underpinning the trademark rights, and also regarding the procedures which are relevant in the different judiciary systems, and of course the very important problem of applicable law. I think that if one moves into these areas, I mean, one can be sure that the process will be very lengthy and very complex. In my presentation, I emphasized the need for prevention, and I think prevention of conflicts is something which allows solutions which to be implemented, which avoids these kind of very complex issue of substantive law and applicable law. I think what we're looking at is something different from the normal judiciary procedures. We're trying to look at something which would give rapid relief and rapid solutions to these type of problems of conflicts of domain names and trademarks, and going down the road towards finding solutions to very complex situation as regards to different systems of granting trademarks, procedures and applicable law, is certainly going to make the whole process very complex and very lengthy. So I think that is perhaps something we should not go. It's not a road which we should necessarily go down. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Betting, you...
Well, I have a short reaction, but in my personal opinion, it will not be possible to avoid those questions. A matter of what if prevention fails? Then you have a question of conflict, and the conflict has to be resolved on the basis of certain substantive criteria, and that's where you need the procedural rules. So I think those very questions that, as you rightly observe, are now also discussed within the European Union and in international fora cannot be evaded by this forum.
Thank you. Mr. Alvestrand, please.
I was sitting here thinking about your suggestion that people should give a prior agreement that they would set up portal sites if required. And I'm kind of thinking of, if I'm a business manager and I'm going to launch a multi-million dollar media campaign which heavily promotes a single domain name, and then I'm asked to sign a paper saying that anyone has the power to challenge me and to remove my rights to use that domain name at very low cost to themselves. That seemed to me something that would be very hard to sell to that media manager. So that strikes me as something I would have a hard time arguing that it's viable for business. I wonder if you comment.
I think you are referring now to the situation where there may be two or more legitimate owners of a domain name, in the sense that they both have a trademark, but in different countries to the same name. Is that correct? You're referring to the suggestion I made about the portal site?
I was referring to the suggestion you made that even though I currently know of no competing rights to this name, I have to sign a paper saying that it's cheap for someone to take the exclusive right to that domain away from me.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you. It's something I did. I stressed the difficulties, the legal difficulties. But I would agree with you that if you were to launch on a campaign like that, and you would have to sign such papers, you would not take out that particular domain name. And I don't think it's something that you would want to do if you were about to invest. And if you look at it from the other side, then it may be a suggestion which is not viable. It was just merely an idea I got when looking at this particular problem of competing rights. And I think it underlines what I said, that such problems should not be subject to the dispute resolution procedure. But are just something that we have to accept as a consequence of the first come, first serve policy.
Mr. Betting, I wonder if I may ask you a question. You said that in your view that any dispute resolution system ought to be restricted to cyber piracy. I wonder if you would like to describe what you understand by cyber piracy.
That's of course. Yeah, well, that's one of the questions I put down as my comment to the questions that were raised in RFC 2. What is a cyber squatter? What is cyber piracy? I think a very crude description of cyber piracy, crude definition, would be that a cyber pirate is someone who applies for a domain name which is identical to somebody else's trademark or trade name, corporate name, and to which apparently he does not have any right. And I would include in those situations the ones that I've seen judgment of in Germany, where somebody registered the domain name Krupp.de, and his name was Krupp, and still the German court said, well, you know, in doing so you're just trying to extort money from the Krupp group of companies, which in fact he did. So maybe that's also an element that you should add, that apparently that person is out for money, which is evident in most of those cases, because they are then offering the domain name for sale.
Yes, I raised the question obviously for the reason of the complication of finding a definition of cyber piracy if one is to lay down a limitation and avoid a jurisdictional dispute at the commencement of every dispute settlement procedure.
I'll try to give a more precise definition in my document.
Thank you. Are there other observations, sir?
Just an observation to make the scenario slightly more difficult, because my name is Kostas Popoter, sorry. I missed the first bit of the presentation, so I don't know whether you touched upon the subject, but I would like to present the reverse side of the situation now. Suppose that you have a famous domain name, Amazon.com, so to say, and a register, a trademark. That would not necessarily have a solution through your system. Maybe I would challenge the thing in front of the court of first instance at the end of the day through the procedures if the trademark is registered, for example, with the Alicante office, or if it's at the national level, there might be conflicts that are much more difficult to resolve. Supposedly you call into application the Brussels Convention, supposedly you call the Rome Convention, or you have a very complex system. Have you thought of such a scenario where the protected right is not necessarily the trademark, but their domain name itself that represents a substantial financial interest?
Yeah, I think your first comment was correct. It is outside the scope of RFC 2, because basically what you are asking is whether you would create any rights in the sense of trademark rights or corporate name rights by merely using a domain name. And that is, again, a question of national law. So it's very difficult to answer that in general. And the protection of a domain name outside the domain name registration system is something which I think is clearly outside the scope of this meeting. I wouldn't mind talking about this with you during the coffee break, but it's very difficult to make more observations, general observations on that right now.
Thank you. Yes, sir, please.
Thank you. Yes. Which role, in your opinion, would play the decision of national courts in domain matters? Like in Germany, courts decided about domain piracy, and they, for example, they forbid the holder of a domain to use the domain. So which role this would play in this dispute settlement policy?
Well, if you choose for this dispute resolution procedure, I think you should exclude the application of national laws, because otherwise you would just get a doubling of procedures, a doubling or you know, you would add to the cost, you would add to the time, you would add to the legal uncertainty. In my view, if you go for this type of procedure, you should exclude that the same parties also put the dispute before a national court. And of course it's very simple, you do that with arbitration, so the complainant will just have to agree to submit it to the alternative dispute resolution procedure. Of course, if the complainant does not do so, but go to national courts, that's something that you cannot avoid, and that certainly this process cannot help to avoid. I mean, that is an option which is always open to a trademark owner. As long as he does not agree to this procedure, he can go anywhere.
Thank you. Mr. Muir, is that?
Just a practical question. One of the issues that was quite intensively discussed in San Francisco in the regional consultation was the situation where the contact details that were provided by the registrant in the domain name application were either non-existent or entirely unreliable. And at least the persons who made the presentations felt that that rendered any resort to court proceedings more difficult, because it was in many cases not really possible to serve process of the proceedings. And I would like to hear your views on that, and particularly two aspects. To what extent do you think there should be any verification stages or any verification at the application stage of either the existence or the reliability of these contact details? That's one question. The second question is, what if these contact details turn out to be wrong? How do you then handle that if you want to bring a case, be it in ADR or in the court, against the registrant?
Well, to answer your first question, I think one thing that you can, of course, ask from someone applying for domain name is, as far if it's a company, an extract from the relevant Register of Companies, the Chamber of Commerce. That's one thing. If it's a person, if you allow a domain name registration by natural persons, which we do not in the Netherlands, but then you could ask for a certificate of domicile. Yes. Of course, that's not foolproof, I know that, but asking the domain name authority to check further on those details would, I think, give it a task which is it does not have the expertise to do, and would involve a lot of cost, would slow down the whole process of registration. I think one of the important things is that the registration should be as quickly as possible. The process should be as efficient as possible. Now, what do you do if you can't find a defendant? Of course, that's a problem you have nowadays as well. People have moved, companies have disappeared, and the national rules of procedure provide for that situation. I don't know how that is in the United States, but certainly in the Netherlands, you could, if the contract details would specify an address and a country, there is a procedure to serve the documents on that person, even though those documents may never have reached him, provided you have fulfilled the formalities. That's okay. That's sufficient for the national court. And that is a principle that has been adopted by all European countries, at least those that are party to the Brussels Convention. I don't know the American system there. I do know that there are a lot of bilateral treaties as well between countries which provide for this situation. So since we have been able to work that out in the days where we didn't have street names but only numbers, I think we can also work this out in this situation.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or observations in relation to Mr. Betting's presentation? That doesn't appear to be the case. May I ask you one final question, and then we shall break for coffee. Naturally, we were interested in your preliminary observation. And the preliminary question, is it necessary to have any alternative dispute resolution procedure? And you cited one particular example, that is an enterprise in, for example, Italy, which has a legitimate right to a trademark and has a domain name registration. And then an enterprise in another European country, which also has a legitimate trademark right. You seem to draw some satisfaction from the existing situation and the existing possibilities. How, in your view, would that situation be resolved at the moment?
Well, I think at the moment, if the Italian domain name owner would also have a national trademark right, I don't think that any court in any country would take away that domain name from that trademark owner.
No, let's suppose it's a Belgian or a Dutch, a .nl domain registration with a trademark right in Italy and a countervailing French trademark right.
Do you mean that the registration was made for the purpose of the domain name?
No, they just exist. They're two enterprises that have existed, and they would like each to take advantage of the possibilities of the single market and expand their operations. And there is one domain name registration, but trademarks.
Yeah. Well, I think if I understand your question correctly. Of course, if you own a trademark in the Benelux and you are confronted with somebody having a domain name and operating a website under that domain name, where the domain name is identical to your trademark, the question may be whether you can oppose that use of the website and the domain name on the basis of your Benelux trademark right, even though the other party may have a legitimate trademark right. But the question then is, is that website also specifically aimed at the Benelux? If it is in Dutch, I think you have a case before a Dutch court to say this website is infringing my trademark rights in the Benelux. Maybe also if it's in French or in German, as you know, also languages used on the territory of the Benelux. So it becomes, you can compare it with the circulation of an international magazine. And we have case law which deals with that use of a trademark by a U.S. company in a U.S. magazine which was circulated in the Netherlands, whereas the identical trademark for the same goods was owned by somebody else. You know, in that case, where the magazine comes to the Netherlands, is distributed there, that's a case of infringement. Now, with websites, you have to be careful. I know there's German, there are some German decisions where the courts have said, well, the website is accessible from Berlin, for instance, and therefore there is a possibility of infringement by that website. I do not think that is sufficient connection. There should also be the text of the website under the domain name should be clearly aimed also at a German audience, which does not necessarily mean that it has to be in German. But, for instance, if it has a German Postfach address or, you know, it quotes prices in German marks. Of course, we're getting into details now, but I think, therefore, that in a situation like that, you will have to look at the facts of the case and to see whether you can protect your national trademark right. But the principle is, does the website under the domain name, and therefore the domain name, infringe my national rights or not? And if it does, you can obtain an injunction, or perhaps even in some an injunction on the use, perhaps, of the German language.
Mr. Betting, thank you very much for your time and thank you very much for your observations. I suggest that we now break for coffee. If I may make two other brief announcements. The first is that I shall ask Mr. Keith Geimer to start after the coffee break. And the second is that perhaps some of you may wish to lunch in the hotel, and this being the case, may wish to foresee the possibility of a reservation during the coffee break now. Thank you.
So, participated in the, and BT participates in the PSWG, which John Wood mentioned, the private sector working group, which is an ad hoc group of 40 or 50 these days major businesses, ranging from media companies to pharmaceuticals and crossing several business sectors. Presently, I'm going to be speaking here with an ICC, International Chamber of Commerce brief, as present chair of the ICC Task Force on Domain Name Issues, which has been providing broad-based business perspective and input to the process, in particular to the formation of the new IANA. Additionally, I will add a few words from time to time on the perspective from the International Trademark Associate, INTA perspective, because I also sit on the INTA Internet Subcommittee, and my colleague on that committee, Geert Glass, is going to be otherwise occupied as an expert, so I have to say a few words for INTA's position as well. The ICC is a very large and well-recognized international business organization. As you can see, it draws its membership from across a very wide profile of businesses and a very wide international base. It has considerable experience in issues like alternative dispute resolution and private sector rulemaking, participating in negotiations and developments on e-commerce regulation at present. The ICC position that I'm going to be outlining here is also explained in more detail in a policy statement and an accompanying commentary on the white paper, of which I have a few copies. I think probably a lot of people will already have seen this anyway, but we can certainly make more copies available if you want to leave me your card or give me your email address. We've certainly taken as our starting point the white paper from the US administration, and we strongly support the recommendations in that paper to move to a private sector stakeholder administration of the domain name system. Our principal concern from the business perspective has always been and remains the stability of the internet. That is crucial to us, that we want to maintain the stability in terms of universal interconnectivity and operation of the network. Obviously, given its name, the ICC is strongly supportive of an internationally representative participation in this new process, in the new organization, and to that end, ICC has itself proposed a number of candidates for the interim board, for consideration for the interim board, for example. Again, as a business-oriented organization, clearly we support open market competitive solutions wherever practicable. At this stage, our position is broadly in favor of, we see the arguments probably more persuasive in terms of having competition at the registrar level rather than necessarily at the GTLD registry level, as we recognize that there is essentially some competition, of course, between country codes at country code TLDs registries already. But again, from a business perspective, that interest in promoting competition is tempered by a very clear and strong belief that we don't want to see competition at all costs that produces simply confusion and chaos in the domain name space, because that won't help us in our objectives either. And that's, I think, this slide summarizes our principles, which objectives are looking at the internet as a commercial medium, where we think it's going. We we'll want to utilize and exploit this opportunity to the best that we can, and that requires, as you can see, operational stability, which I mentioned before. We want global recognition, global participation in this. From a business perspective, we are, as you can imagine, keen on having consistent and coherent procedures around the world, so that businesses which are operating in one area can rely on at least similar, broadly similar procedures being applicable in other parts of the world, in the same way as they would if you were doing international contractual arrangements, for example. To that end, obviously, we've been supporting and calling for very clearly for adequate business representation, broad-based commercial representation in these, in the new bodies dealing with this administration. Business is quite clear that it recognises that the commercial investment that's driving the growth of the internet is going to be coming principally from private enterprise in the future, and from people wanting to come on the internet and do the business on the internet. That's going to fund the increase, the growth of the information infrastructure, the development of new services. And businesses, again, commercially, are going to be a principal name, principal
hearing. If I may say a few